From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. More airstrikes in Yemen. France foils terror plot against churches. Imminent threat of spring offensive by Afghan Taliban. Scientists consider possibilities for a mega drought in California. These stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. A Saudi-led coalition launched the air raids Wednesday, hours after announcing a halt to a month-long bombing campaign. They hit Houthi rebel positions in the central city of Taiz and in the southern port of Aden. As ground fighting between rebels and supporters of exiled President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi continued in both areas. In Taiz, the rebels seized control of a military brigade headquarters from forces backing Mr. Hadi before an airstrike hit the area. The International Committee of the Red Cross says the humanitarian situation in Yemen is nothing short of catastrophic. Lisa Schlein reports.
The head of ICRC operations for the Near and Middle East, Robert Mardini, has just returned from a three-day visit to the capital, Sana'a, and bears witness to the grim reality of life in Yemen. He says the resilience of the Yemeni people has been eroded to the breaking point, and that people are ill-equipped to cope with the current situation and its aftermath.
Nowhere is safe in Yemen today. Nearly a month of death and destruction after years of crisis leaves little hopes for Yemenis to lead a normal life. The recent reports we got from our teams from Aden, Sana'a, Taiz are alarming. Tens of thousands have been displaced and sought shelter in schools and mosques. Hundreds have been arrested.
Mardini describes the damage to property and infrastructure by the airstrikes and ground fighting as absolutely shocking. He says indiscriminate shootings are a constant threat to the entire population. He also says aid workers and ambulances are under attack, noting that three Red Crescent volunteers have been killed and two wounded in the line of duty since March 26th. He says many hospitals are open but lack medicines and medical staff as the number of wounded is rising. He says millions of people are short of basic goods and services. They lack food, water, fuel, and drugs, and this is leading to soaring prices for the most basic commodities. Despite the many hardships and multiple threats facing its staff, Mardini says the ICRC will not be deterred from carrying out its humanitarian operations. He says the Red Cross plans to scale up its activities.
We made the deliberate choice to keep our teams present and operational since 26 March. Going forward, we will pursue our efforts and further reinforce our presence and action. We will continue to act as a neutral intermediary to ensure safe movement of trapped civilians. We will continue our support to hospitals and health structures. We will do more to meet people's need for food and water. We will continue to work with the local water authorities to keep the water flowing and backup power facilities running.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is launching a preliminary $15 million appeal to cover this emergency response. This is in addition to the nearly $29 million it has already budgeted for its operations in Yemen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
European Union leaders gather in Brussels today to discuss possible solutions to a growing migrant crisis highlighted by the mass drowning of hundreds of migrants off the Libyan coast. The rights group Amnesty International called on European leaders to launch a humanitarian effort to what it calls a spiraling tragedy of migrant shipwrecks on the Mediterranean. European authorities continue to investigate how a migrant boat bound from strife-torn Libya to the southern Italian island of Lampedusa capsized last weekend, with as many as 900 people drowning and only 28 rescued. Italian prosecutors say that the ship's Tunisian captain, who's been arrested, mistakenly rammed his boat into a Portuguese container ship that was coming to its rescue. French police say they have foiled a terror plot targeting one or more churches near Paris. Lisa Bryant has details.
France's Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says police have arrested a 24-year-old French Algerian IT student who's suspected of being an Islamist extremist. The man was taken into custody on Sunday. It's not immediately clear why the authorities made the announcement on Wednesday.
Dimanche matin à Paris, dans le 13e arrondissement, la police a découvert dans le véhicule.
Cazeneuve says police discovered an arsenal of weapons in his car parked in a Paris neighborhood. He said they also discovered documents showing the suspect allegedly planned on carrying out an attack on one or two churches in the Paris suburb of Villejuif. Police were reportedly alerted when the man called an ambulance after he apparently shot himself in the leg. He's also suspected in the killing of a woman who was found shot dead in her car in Villejuif. News reports say police are questioning his family. Cazeneuve says the man has been on the police radar for some time because he planned to leave for Syria. Hundreds of French youth have headed to Syria and Iraq in recent months to join extremist groups.
Notre pays, comme d'autres, encore ces dernières semaines, fait face à une menace.
In a statement, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said France, like other nations, is facing an unprecedented terrorist threat that the country must face with lucidity and determination. Thousands of police and soldiers are guarding synagogues, media outlets, and other sensitive sites around France since the January terrorist attack that killed 17 people around Paris. The shootings targeted Jews, the media, and the police. Analyst Frédéric Ancel said the foiled church plot has shifted the focus on Christians as targets.
Les églises en particulier sont considérées comme le saint ou ont été considérées pendant très longtemps.
Ancel told France Info Radio that today's radical Islamists have revived old views of churches as symbols of Western imperialism and meddling, regardless of their denomination. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The European Union charged Russian energy giant Gazprom with antitrust violations Wednesday in a move that could further aggravate tensions between Russia and the EU. The EU's competition commissioner says Gazprom abuses its dominant position in Central and Eastern European countries by imposing contract stipulations that hinder competition and allow Gazprom to raise its prices. Gazprom says the company is a strategic government-controlled business entity empowered by the laws of the Russian Federation and, therefore, beyond the jurisdiction of the European Union.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
It's springtime in Afghanistan, and that means not a good time. Afghanistan's Taliban says it'll unleash its spring offensive this Friday to intensify attacks on embassies and government facilities, as well as military targets throughout the country. Ayaz Ghul has details.
The Taliban has been waging an insurgency since it was removed from power in 2001 by Afghan and U.S.-led international forces. The insurgent group increases attacks around Afghanistan in the spring after the snow melt when fighters and weapons can move in the mountainous country along the porous border with Pakistan. In an announcement released to the media, including VOA, the Taliban says this year's spring offensive has been dubbed Azm or Resolution and will begin Friday. The name resembles the NATO-led two-year Resolute Support operation that was launched in January to train and advise Afghan security forces after most foreign combat troops withdrew from Afghanistan last year. President Ashraf Ghani has been making efforts with the support of neighboring countries, including Pakistan, to open a peace dialogue with the Taliban. In recent weeks, his efforts generated hopes for a peaceful end to the Afghan conflict. The Taliban, however, made no mention of a peace process. Its spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid reiterated to VOA that no talks are possible unless foreign forces completely withdraw from Afghanistan and a sovereign government is installed in Kabul that is free of foreign influence. Mr. Ghani has also been consulting members of the so-called High Peace Council his predecessor had set up to promote peace with the Taliban. Council senior member Mohammad Ismail Qasim Yar responded to the Taliban announcement by urging the militants not to indulge in further bloodshed of their countrymen and women.
You know, killing in war and fighting is not the answer. And later or soon, which we hope that sooner the better, the political solution would be the way out. And we continue to say that peace is better.
Qasim Yar acknowledged cooperation between Afghanistan and Pakistan has improved in recent months to promote peace in his country.
I'm sure if Pakistan is using its influence and closeness with the Taliban, that would be effective, and that would bear, I'm sure, fruits as far as the starting peace talks concerned. We see signs of better understanding of the situation.
The United Nations and independent observers have warned that 2015 is likely to be the bloodiest year in Afghanistan, with Afghan forces bracing to fight without direct foreign air and ground support. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The leaders of Japan and China met privately Wednesday at the Asia-Africa Summit in Jakarta, but it is not clear if they moved any closer to resolving their differences over Japan's past wartime aggression. VOA's Brian Patton reports the meeting followed a conflicting flurry of outreach and provocation between the two countries.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Chinese President Xi Jinping met for about half an hour on the sidelines of a leaders' summit in Indonesia. The meeting could be a sign that the two sides may be willing to begin a dialogue to resolve their differences over China's concerns that Japan is trying to rewrite history and exonerate itself from World War II atrocities. Afterwards, Mr. Abe told reporters they agreed to work for better relations. The two men also shook hands when they first met at the conference earlier Wednesday, and during his speech to the delegates, Prime Minister Abe expressed remorse in the spirit of the founding principles of the conference, solidarity and cooperation. He says Japan, with feelings of deep remorse over the past war, made a pledge to remain a nation always adhering to those very principles. South Korea's foreign ministry criticized Mr. Abe for omitting what it says are needed expressions of apology and repentance. Mr. Abe also said in his speech that the use of force by more powerful countries to coerce the weak should not be allowed. It was a comment that many believe was directed at China. Also on Wednesday, about 100 Japanese lawmakers visited a controversial shrine in Tokyo that honors the country's war dead but includes the names of 14 infamous war criminals. The prime minister earlier this week sent an offering to the shrine. China and South Korea view these visits by Japanese nationalists as provocative acts that demonstrate Japan's unwillingness to repent for its wartime past. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei Wednesday protested the visit. He says China expresses strong opposition to Japanese politicians visiting the Yasukuni Shrine. This year is the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Lei said in this sensitive year, Japanese politicians should adhere to correct historical views and do more to promote reconciliation and mutual trust with its Asian neighbors and not the opposite. Next week, Mr. Abe will travel to the United States and address a joint session of Congress. His speech will be closely watched to see if and how he addresses the sensitive issue of Japan's wartime past. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
Nuclear talks between Iran and six major powers resumed Wednesday in Vienna. The parties have a June 30th deadline to turn a framework agreement into a final deal that keeps Iran from building a nuclear bomb while easing sanctions against Tehran. The framework nuclear deal between Iran and global powers is opening up new investment possibilities in an economy that's been stunted by international sanctions. Last week, a top Iranian atomic energy official said, in addition to Russia, China will also help it build additional nuclear power plants. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
China has not commented on the proposal, but Iran says Beijing could help it build at least three nuclear plants in the coastal city of Bashir. The city is home to Iran's first nuclear plant, the construction of which began four decades ago. Germany started work there in the 1970s, but that effort was halted during Iran's Islamic Revolution. After that, Russia took over in the 1990s, but it was not until 2013 the plant was operating at full capacity. Oil-rich Iran says it needs nuclear power to meet its energy needs. Uranium fuels nuclear reactors, but also can be used to make nuclear bombs. Iran and world powers are seeking to reach final agreement on a deal by late June. Lin Bochang, the director of the China Center for Energy Economic Research at Xiamen University, says China is well-positioned to be a key player in Iran's nuclear energy program. Lin says China has great strength when it comes to the construction of power plants, given that most of the new plants being built in the world today are in China. He says the export of nuclear energy is also something that is essential to the transitioning of the Chinese economy. Late last year, the International Atomic Energy Agency for the first time approved a Chinese-designed reactor, giving it the green light for domestic production as well as exports. Last week, the Chinese government approved the construction of the country's first third-generation nuclear reactor, the Hualong 1. China is trying to build up its own brand of reactors, says Matthew Cotti, a research analyst with the International Institute for Strategic Studies Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Program.
The Hualong 1 is currently being built in China, but it's going to take a while before the international community kind of has that trust in a new reactor type that hasn't actually been built anywhere else.
Analysts say that first reactor could take 6 to 8 years to build, but China is already exporting the technology abroad. Chinese media say a power station under development in Karachi, Pakistan, could be the first Hualong 1 built outside China. And Argentina also has agreed on a deal to build one in the South American country. Beijing also has a bilateral deal with Romania and a potential deal with Turkey. If China carries through on building reactors in Iran, it could partner with another foreign country to mitigate the political risk of such a sensitive project. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Friday marks the 100th anniversary of the World War I Battle of Gallipoli, when Ottoman Turks defeated a British-led invasion. On the same day, Armenians around the world will mark the 100th anniversary of the mass killings, which Armenians describe as genocide by the Ottomans, of its Armenian minority. The calamitous events are captured in the story of a Turkish-Armenian army officer, Captain Sarkis Tarossian. But the publication of his memoirs of fighting at the Battle of Gallipoli is causing controversy today in Turkey, as Dorian Jones explains.
Captain Tarossian's story deals with many taboos and dark chapters in Ottoman history. Even though he was a decorated Ottoman army officer, that fact did not save his mother and sisters, who perished during the mass deportation of Armenians by the Ottoman rulers. The mass deportation has been dubbed as a genocide by many, a label that Ankara vehemently denies. The most contentious part of his story, according to Professor Ayhan Akhtar of Istanbul's Bilgi University, is that Tarossian fought at the crucial World War I Battle of Gallipoli. He says Tarossian's story contradicts both Turkey's official version of events, that only Turks fought at Gallipoli, as well as the latest Islamist interpretation of the battle.
When you form a Turkish republic based upon ethnic nationalism, then you try to rewrite history. In the last 15 years, a kind of an Islamic narrative started. They started to talk about kind of scents are coming from the sky and protecting the glorious Islamic army against the infidel. You know, in both narratives, in the Turkish narrative, in the Islamic narrative, poor Captain Tarossian is a persona non grata. He doesn't have any place. He's not a Turk to take place in the Turkish narrative, and he's not a Muslim, he's a Christian, and therefore he doesn't fit to the Islamic narrative.
The importance of Torossian's story, Akhtar says, is why publishers were persuaded to print it in Turkey. While Akhtar says he was aware the book was controversial, he was surprised by the unlikely alliance of Turkish secular nationalists, Islamists, and even the army attacking it.
I mean, I wasn't expecting such a debate. I wasn't expecting such a fury. They told me that I was naive, I was cheated by the text, and they tried to discredit the book, saying that this guy is a systematic liar. When the Torossian debate started, the Turkish chief of staff made an official declaration saying that there was no officer called Sarkis Torossian on Gallipoli front in 1915.
Turkish President Erdogan acknowledged the veracity of the story, citing it in a communique to his Armenian counterpart, Serzh Sargsyan, in a bid to persuade him to attend Gallipoli commemorations. The offer was refused. Akhtar says the controversy has opened the door to other accounts of Armenian officers who fought at Gallipoli becoming known.
This debate on Captain Torossian initiated another upsurge of research about who were these officers in the Ottoman army. Actually, I'm very proud of it. While we are commemorating a battle, a resistance or heroism, we should never forget the ones who were fighting with us. This is very important and we should pay respect.
The role and even presence of Armenian officers within the ranks of the Ottoman army at the Battle of Gallipoli remains contentious. But observers say the Torossian controversy and the publishing of similar stories mean another historical taboo in Turkey has been challenged and is now being discussed. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
In Chile, authorities are evacuating hundreds of people after the volcano Calbuco erupted Wednesday for the first time in more than 42 years. The National Mining and Geology Service issued a high alert barring access to the mountainous area around the volcano in southern Chile. About 1,500 people were being evacuated from towns more than 1,000 kilometers south of the capital, Santiago. President Obama visited the Everglades National Park in Florida Wednesday to send the American people the message that climate change can no longer be denied. During his visit to the more than 600,000-hectare park, Mr. Obama spoke about the seriousness of the issue.
Yes, this winter was cold in parts of our country, including Washington. But around the world, in the aggregate, it was the warmest winter ever recorded. This is not a problem for another generation. Not anymore. This is a problem now. It has serious implications for the way we live right now.
Mr. Obama used his Earth Day trip to the ecologically sensitive Everglades to highlight the real impact climate change is making on the environment, people's health, their livelihoods, and the local economy. California is coping with one of its most serious droughts in decades. The snowpack in the Sierra Mountains, which provides 30% of the state's water in normal years, stands at record low levels. State Governor Jerry Brown implemented the state's strictest-ever conservation measures. VOA's Michael Sullivan reports that scientists and officials meeting near Los Angeles say a worst-case scenario, a mega-drought, is possible, but unlikely.
The snowpack in the Sierra Mountains was at its lowest recorded level, just 5% of normal, in early April. State climatologist Michael Anderson says the snow should be melting now and flowing to reservoirs, peaking in early May and continuing into July.
This year, with almost no snow there, there really is very little streamflow picking up. There won't be any noticeable peak in it. Tailing off will occur earlier. There will probably be parts of the Sierra that will go dry.
The state must rely on water stored in reservoirs or pumped from underground. Groundwater is now the source of water for farmers in California's Central Valley, and scientists say the aquifers there are being depleted. Scientists and officials are sharing climate data at a three-day conference at the University of California, Irvine. They say that in addition to scanty rainfall, the state is coping with higher temperatures, which have reduced snowfall in the mountains and increased the runoff from infrequent rainstorms. Martin Herling of the U.S. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration says droughts are cyclical, but temperatures are also 1 degree Celsius warmer than usual.
It's been warmer than that the last couple of years. It's probably been as much as 3, maybe 4 degrees Celsius. That's 5, 6 more degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average, especially in the spring and summer.
The record preserved in the rings of tree trunks shows that 1,000 years ago, California experienced a so-called mega drought that lasted decades. The state is now in its fourth year of drought, but water management expert Jay Lund of the University of California, Davis, says a drought of 4 or 5 years is not so unusual.
Yeah, we've survived similar droughts in the past. I think we'll survive this one, although we will certainly suffer in the meantime, particularly agricultural water users and some of the native species ecosystems.
He believes the state could adapt to a longer drought if it had to. Janine Jones of the California Department of Water Resources says state officials are responding.
Improving water conservation, improving groundwater management, encouraging local agencies to implement integrated regional water management so they can build together on a regional scale to improve their water supply reliability. So yes, it's a very busy time for us.
California Governor Jerry Brown this month ordered the state's growing population to cut water use by 25%. And last year he signed legislation that regulates the use of groundwater. Voters have approved a $7.5 billion bond for drought relief and improving the state's water infrastructure. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Irvine, California.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council has adopted a resolution which seeks to stop the violent takeover of Yemen by the Houthis and bring all parties back to the negotiating table. In recent months, the Houthis seized large swaths of territory in Yemen and forced the elected president, Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi, to flee the country. In response to Houthi aggression and at President Hadi's request, Saudi Arabia and Gulf Cooperation Council members have been conducting airstrikes against rebel positions in Yemen. President Barack Obama authorized the provision of U.S. logistical and intelligence support to the Saudi-led military operations. Security Council Resolution 2216 was adopted on April 14th by a vote of 14-0, with Russia abstaining. It imposes a global asset freeze and travel ban on 2 key Houthi leaders, as well as a targeted arms embargo on former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, his son, and their supporters. This is in addition to UN sanctions already imposed by the Security Council on former President Saleh and 2 Houthi commanders last November. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power said the United States strongly supports the Security Council resolution,
which imposes consequences on the Houthi and former President Saleh, demands that the Houthi cease military operations, and calls on all sides to once again return to the negotiating table. The imposition of a global asset freeze and travel ban on Ahmed Ali Saleh and Abdelmalek al-Houthi, as well as a targeted arms embargo, shows that this council will take action against those who continue to undermine efforts toward reconciliation.
Ambassador Power noted that the Security Council resolution recognizes the rapidly deteriorating humanitarian conditions in Yemen and urges all sides to comply with their obligations under international law and facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance to civilians in need. The actions the Houthis have taken threaten the security and the welfare of the Yemeni people and the region, said Ambassador Power. The UN, she said, must continue its efforts to hold talks to find a consensus solution to this crisis, and all parties must commit to taking part in these talks. There is no alternative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.